I know our brother Johnny doesn't need any introduction to you with flowery words and all kinds of nice things. So I'll just get out of his way and let him do what the Lord's called him to do. I'll give to you our brother priest, John Bell.
Thank you, Bob. And I do appreciate that I don't have to try to live up to anything flowery, because usually when I've tried to do that, I've embarrassed myself and everybody else around me. I don't very often preach a whole sermon out of the hymn book, but in recent days, one of our hymns has been in my mind off and on quite a bit. And it's "Tell Me the Story of Jesus." And so I start asking myself, how do I do that? How would I introduce Jesus to somebody that doesn't know him? Well, I could begin and just read the book of Hebrews, because essentially that's what Paul did, was address himself to a nation that didn't know Jesus and say, I want you to know this man Jesus, the Son of God, as I know him. And as we think it over a little bit, I believe you would likely agree with me that the story of Jesus is the story of life. Ideally, a child should have no idea when he first heard of Jesus. It should be that in every family, and it is in most of our families I know, and many other families, that his name is just a part of normal conversation in a home. His name and his teachings and his miracles and his words, all the things that we know of him, just make their way in our conversation, and they ought to. Should be the commonest name in our vocabulary, probably. Not every parent should have to spend more time saying "No, Johnny," than they do saying "Now Jesus said." And as we do hear of him in our homes, we also hear a great deal of the things that apply so easily to our lives. The mention of things that appear in his parables and in his other philosophical talk. Jesus was a philosopher. When he said, "You have heard that it has been said by them of old time," and then name a common saying, then he'd say, "But I say to you," and he would tell them the spiritual intent of what was being said and sometimes missaid. So we think of those things, and we call somebody a good Samaritan, and we speak of the widow's mite. Those of us who have more experience know this story. But for the benefit of those that haven't heard it very many times, I'm going to read that incident. It was a real incident and not a parable. 12th chapter of Mark, at verse 41, we'll begin to read. "And Jesus sat over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain a poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he called unto him his disciples, and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you, that this poor widow hath cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. And we likely have known people on, to some degree, on both sides of this matter. It takes a lot of money to run a church. We obtain money from the generosity of members and some other people. And usually, the money doesn't represent a very considerable sacrifice. Sometimes no sacrifice at all, as he saw the rich people who had plenty of money left, so that when they had put the money in the treasury, it didn't affect their standard of living any at all. Most of us at some time in our life have felt that we should give money to the church. That did affect our standard of living somewhat. That we could have used that money for something useful and honorable, but something we could get along without. And yet, I doubt that any of us did as he said the poor widow did, to give her living, to give all she had. And it says in my footnote that it's less than a penny. So this woman, I want us to think about that just a little bit. To out of her love for the Lord, give what she couldn't afford, and what, if she had lived off it first, she couldn't have given. It's sacrifice and dedication that's so uncommon in the world that it should attract our notice, and it should stop us to think about it and maybe talk about it a little bit. Because it's a large thing that he saw the woman do, and so he said, this woman has done more than all the rest of these because of the magnitude of her gift in relation to what she is able to do. As we think of these other things that Jesus did and said, and as other people, you notice how many people refer to things out of the Bible, people that we don't think of as being acquainted with the Bible. And think of our state legislatures who in the past few years, 30 or so, most of them have passed what they call a Good Samaritan law. Those people, for the most part, don't give one moment of thought to the Bible. But when they're passing this law, but when they stop for a moment, they're vaguely aware that most of these common adages that we use do actually come from the Bible. Great numbers of them, common proverbs and other scriptures. And most of us, by the time we reach mature age, know somebody who we would tend to judge as living the life of the prodigal son. We know that people are, there are people all around us who are wasteful of their opportunity and are wasteful of their living. And we remember that in the book of Isaiah, the Lord said, I have created the smith that blows the coals in the fire and brings forth an instrument to his work, close to those words. And I have created the waster to destroy. So we know that we are going to encounter those who waste their time, their money, and their opportunity. And we kick ourselves all over because we fear that we have wasted an opportunity sometimes when we just were too slow on the uptake, or for whatever other reason, we look back and say, I had a chance to do a good deed here and I passed it up. I had a chance to tell somebody somewhat of the precious story of Jesus and I missed it. Well, let's not accuse ourselves too deeply and call ourselves the waster that he created to destroy. But we should take notice of that too and feel it keenly. When the Lord blessed Abram, we know the story. We love it. We're going to hear it. A part of it again in just a bit. We know that Jesus was part of that promise. He wasn't named. There was no real reference to him. But we do know that he is a part of it and a part of that rich promise. And it's worth our time to review it in our minds now and again. In the 12th chapter of Genesis, we have this account, beginning at verse 1. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. I think it's also remarkable that Abram lived there until he was 75 years old. But he lived there until his father died. We feel often that we have some obligation and we would feel that perhaps we were abandoning our own if we moved away from a parent and the parent had no family left with them. Our fortunes take us many places, but we feel comforted if we know that some of our family is close by, if our parents in their old age need them. I think it's wise, I think it's good that we feel that way. And I think that the Lord took note of that he didn't give this commandment to Abram until after his father had died, and I don't think he'd been dead long. Okay. Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. So Abram did as the Lord told him. And he has a long and good story to be told from there on. A story that covers things he did that showed a lapse of faith and that showed the strength of his faith. But we're not going to concentrate on them now, just that he did as he was told. And the Lord said, I'll bless you, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. And we understand that blessing to be the promise of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Then if we take just another incident that deals with the life of Jesus, we might read in the first of the book of John, and I thought it was going to get read to us this morning, but it didn't. And I want to begin at the first of that chapter where Jim started at about the sixth verse, I believe. Excuse me. This testimony of John, a testimony based on his certain understanding of the truth of the Lord and his mission. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. That seems to be a kind of a roundabout way of saying things, but in him was the fullness of life. The reason, the real reason why we were born. The real reason why Adam fell, so that he would be the father of all mankind, and so that he brought death upon mankind, and then Jesus would return to bring life, the opportunity for life to all mankind. Nothing was made that was not made involving him. And he tells us other places, and his servants tell us other places, that he is the very eternal Father of heaven and earth. And that's why Abinadi called him God. And that he was the one who actually was the physical force of the creation, I believe, while the Father was the spiritual mover. That may be a clumsy way of saying what I think I gather from this. But we who believe that he did bring about the creation, we have found ourselves to be more and more in the minority as years go by. But I hope that from time to time we have stopped and tried to sort that out a little bit in our minds and asked ourselves, now just how can this be? How could it be that he was with the Father in the beginning and the Father used him to accomplish the creation? And when Jesus was speaking in the Book of Mormon concerning the law of Moses, he said, I gave that law, and I fulfilled it. And then how could he come and be born of a woman, an innocent and ignorant baby, and grow up as a dutiful son of good people and take up his father's labor that he was appointed to, then die and be resurrected, and then take up his place again beside the Father? How can that be? Did we ever ask ourselves that? I sure hope we did. I hope we have pondered it very deeply and came to the conclusion, we don't know. We can't know. It's beyond the mortal understanding to be able to say, this is how that came about. Unbelievers will ask and taunt and say, how can that be? We don't know. we don't need to know. Because if we can believe that it's true, that's good enough. And give the testimony that the Spirit has witnessed to our soul that it is true. And as we have read many of these accounts, that from time to time, the Spirit rests upon us and gives us a glow and a stirring that tells us this is true, this is precious, this is something to think about. Abraham Lincoln was speaking of the Bible, and he said, take all of this book on reason that you can. But this sort of thing escapes the reasoning of men, and consequently, unbelieving men are going to challenge it all the time. But he went on and he said, and take the balance on faith, and you will live and die a better and happier man. We see that a lot of the scripture is very reasonable, that it deals with things that we know in life, that we experience. But there's a large balance to take on faith. And if we have that faith, that we can believe it without wavering, without saying, well, you may be right, but no, those who don't believe are not right, but not even any at all. But our own study and our own thinking about the story of Jesus in bits and pieces as it comes to us, they're going to challenge us, and they're going to ask us these very facts that we read and that we hear from each other are going to ask us, do I believe that? Do I wholeheartedly believe that? The best answer is yes. Toward the end of that 3 days of darkness after the crucifixion of Christ, when he came and made himself known to the people, I want to read a little of that for you. On page 628, when he first made himself known to them, have to break into the middle of the incident. But I'm going to read for you, beginning on verse 44. The darkness was still on the earth, and the people had heard a voice, and they were told a number of things. And then he said this, behold, I am Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I created the heaven and the earth and all things that in them are. I was with the Father from the beginning. I am in the Father, and the Father in me, and in me hath the Father glorified his name. How many of those people do you suppose believed that? I suppose that every one of them believed it, and so do you. They had just been lamenting to themselves and to each other, oh, if we had just believed the prophets, if we had not stoned them, if we had not cast them out, if we had not killed them, all this wouldn't have had to happen. All of these people that we knew and loved wouldn't be dead. Some covered up by the earth, some drowned in the sea, some destroyed in the fire, some destroyed in the earthquake. I'm positive that they believed him wholeheartedly when he said, I am Jesus Christ, and these other things that he told them there that were were their introduction to him. And not very much later, when he came to them in the flesh, in the spiritual flesh, I might correct myself somewhat. You recall it was the darkness had dispersed. A period of time had gone by, and we don't know how much. But there was a group of people around the temple that was in the land Bountiful, and they heard a voice. Just where am I going to break into that now? I'm going to start at verse 8 on page 632. And this voice saith unto them, Behold my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, in whom I have glorified my name. Hear ye him. And it came to pass, as they understood, they cast their eyes up again towards heaven, and behold, they saw a man descending out of heaven. And he was clothed in a white robe, and he came down and stood in the midst of them. And the eyes of the whole multitude were turned upon him, and they durst not open their mouths, even one to another, and wist not what it meant, for they thought it was an angel that had appeared unto them. And it came to pass that he stretched forth his hand and spake unto the people, saying, Behold, I am Jesus Christ, of which the prophets testified should come into the world. And behold, I am the light and the life of the world, and I have drunk out of that bitter cup which the Father hath given me, and have glorified the Father in taking upon me the sins of the world, in the which I have suffered the will of the Father in all things from the beginning. And it came to pass that when Jesus had spoken these words, the whole multitude fell to the earth, for they remembered that it had been prophesied among them that Christ should shew himself unto them after his ascension into heaven. Who all believed? Everybody. Do you suppose it could be taken from them? Few, if any, I think, could ever lose track of that. The devil has a lot of power and is persuasive. But I doubt, personally, that he was ever able to take that testimony from any of those people. Now, in a few generations, we know that the devil had managed to turn the hearts of nearly that whole nation away from the Lord. But an important part of the story of Jesus is that these people believed him wholeheartedly. And yet, there are now great multitudes of people that have grown up acquainted with this Book of Mormon, who now tell themselves, well, I'm too smart to believe all of those fables, all those old wives' tales. Some of that stuff just really doesn't hang together, and so they wander away. And some who don't wander away don't really have it all in their hearts where they can cling to it and draw on it for strength, for reassurance. Quite a number of years ago, I was in a Sunday school class, and I made a statement that one of the members of the church challenged. And I looked it up in the Book of Mormon and read it to the group. And this unfortunate person listened and said, I can't accept that. Well, that was pretty much the end of that discussion. But every once in a while, it comes back to me. And I think, why didn't I have the presence of mind to say, what do you cling to? What do you find that brings you the assurance you need when things are not like you wish they were. I don't think very fast on my feet. I think time and again of something long after it's too late. Oh, how I wish I had thought to share this testimony, that rebuttal, and I didn't manage to do it. No, the feelings toward the Book of Mormon are not even universal in the Church of Christ. But I want to read now for you a passage that'll leave a better taste in your mouth. This is in the 9th chapter of the book of Matthew. You recall an incident when Jesus was going to heal the daughter of a ruler, and before he got there, the child died, and he went and revived her and brought her back to life. He didn't revive her from unconsciousness. He brought her to life from the dead. And then this is very shortly after that. Chapter 9 of Matthew, verse 27. And when Jesus departed thence, two blind men followed him, crying, "Thou Son of David, have mercy on us." And when he was come into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus saith unto them, "Believe ye that I am able to do this?" They said unto him, "Yea, Lord." Then touched he their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, be it unto you." And their eyes were opened, and Jesus straitly charged them, saying, "See that no man know it." But they, when they were departed, spread abroad his fame in all that country. I want to back up now to when he said, "Do you believe that I can do this?" Because too often we say, "Am I good enough? Am I good enough for the Lord's church? Am I good enough to ask the Lord for help? Am I good enough to obtain his blessings?" Jesus didn't say to these men, "Do you deserve for me to heal your blindness?" He said, "Do you believe? Do you believe I can?" And they said, "Yes. Yes, we do." And so he did. And one more thing that I think is really, really important in that, though he told them, "Don't tell it," they went out of there so full of the wonderment, the unspeakable joy of being healed from that infirmity, much more than an infirmity. And they were totally unable to contain the news of what he had done. They simply, I think, could not keep themselves from telling it to everybody that would listen. I can't imagine what it would be to have a restoration such as that brought about in my life. I haven't ever been badly crippled. I've been hampered than I am today. But something like that, what a marvelous thing it would be. And how would you ever keep it to yourself? I don't think so. I think that I have, in some measure, managed to really appreciate this, because there have been times when a troubling series of events was coming to a head, and I and sometimes my family and sometimes not had prayed long and anxiously over it. And when it seemed that Satan had almost won, that it was almost over and the catastrophe was upon us, that the Lord intervened. And it was no more a problem. He took it away. And the wonderment then, the knowledge I was not worthy, and I tried my very dead level best to believe, to not doubt, and yet was surprised. Yet was surprised when he went ahead and did it for me, because I did feel rather keenly how undeserving I really was. And I believe that it's the same wonderment and delight that filled those two men. Well, like most of us, I still have very large concerns that trouble my mind. Concerns that exist within the framework of my family, concern of things that exist in the church, of my larger family, the family of my ancestors, family of the church, and the nation and the world. Very, very things that weigh very heavily upon me. And have the hope that before the devil can win, before the catastrophe falls all over us, the Lord's hand will be shown. A faith that's born of that knowledge and experience, even though we feel the fear and the trembling, the uncertainty, because we see things go on and on. We have a sort of a story that we know within my family that we repeat from time to time that deals with this. And we can say it without too much heavy emotion. In my work in the powerhouse, very often I found myself working on machinery at the ground level, and sometimes beneath the floor level, kneeling on iron gratings or on concrete floors or on gravel. And before many years went by, I learned to keep a small piece of quarter-inch plywood handy. And the welders kept some protective blanketing that they could spread over electrical equipment or painted equipment or whatever to keep the splatters from their work from flying and damaging something else. And I kept a piece of that folded up behind my toolbox on the bench so I could grab that and take it with me and get down on my knees on that so they wouldn't hurt so badly. One day I was at our family doctor's office for a checkup, and he looked at my knees and he said, "You spend an awful lot of time on your knees." And I didn't even think. I was born, I think, with sort of a smart mouth. But I didn't think at all when he said that. I said, "You have no idea." And at that time, we had a matter that was troubling us pretty deeply. And besides the hard work that I was having to do on my knees, I was at that time spending a lot of time on my knees. And so we repeat that to each other from time to time. You spend a lot of time on your knees. And it should show. It should show in the life we live and in the conversation that we share together and the things that we make important to us, the things that we're delighted in and the things that we're worried about should indicate that we spend a lot of time on our knees, because there are so many things in life that natural reason would seem to tell us cannot be. And yet, as we believe in the Lord and cling to His word as being the great truth of the world, things that have to be. Remember when Jesus said, I have to tell you a little of the story of Jesus, don't lie before we quit. Here's another small item that you know very well. When he told the people that were following him, just lumps them together and calls them disciples, and he said, you must eat my flesh and drink my blood, or you have no life in you. That struck some of them wrong. And they couldn't see that it had a spiritual side to it, and that's what he was speaking of. They only saw the physical possibility of what he said, and they said, this is too hard. I want to tell you a small item that Jack told me a couple of 3 years ago that's right along this line. He had in his scout troop a Mormon kid, and they went on a trek to a camp where they were over a weekend, and he took this Mormon kid to their church because he wanted to go, and Jack said, I'll be glad to take him. And they did what they do. And after it was over, the kid says, I just drank the Lord's blood. And he made some expression of revulsion. And it took quite a little while for him to explain to the kid, you didn't drink blood. You drank something that was offered to you as a token of the Lord's blood, because the Lord has commanded us that we take his flesh and his blood, that we feast upon a part of his life and take part and be a part of his life, or we have no life in him. And finally satisfied the kid. But these people were not satisfied with this, and I'm going to read for you in John chapter 6. I don't know how much of this to read either. I'll begin in verse 61. This was right after the people said, this is a tough thing. This is a hard saying, they said. Who can hear it? When Jesus knew in himself that his disciples murmured at it, he said unto them, doth this offend you? What an if you see the Son of Man ascend up where he was before? It is the Spirit that quickeneth, the flesh profiteth nothing. He was showing them, I was telling you things that pertain to the Spirit, not to eating the flesh of a man and drinking of the blood of a man. The flesh profiteth nothing. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. And there are some of you that believe not. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not and who should betray him. And he said, therefore said I unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him of my Father. From that time many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. Then Jesus said unto the 12, will ye also go away? How many times do we repeat this and the answer? They're precious to us. They need to be fresh in our mind. Then Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life. And we believe and are sure that thou art that Christ, the Son of the living God. The answer is the very essence of the life of Christ. First, there were those who said, I can't accept that. And there were these who said, where else would we go? There ain't any place else to go. You have the words of eternal life. And we believe and we're sure that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. I want to read for you in Deuteronomy what I would almost call the universal commandment. It's in chapter 6. And I'm going to begin at verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house. And when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up, and thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And then he went ahead and told them again of the promise that God had made to Abraham of the land and the wonders that the Lord was going to do. But first, believe. Love the Lord and talk about it. Tell your children. Converse with them early in the morning and late at night. When you walk outside together and when you sit at ease together. Let him be a part of your conversation because he has to be the entirety of your hope. We read here a little and there a little, it tells us. And we read the same of the life and ministry of Christ as we do all of the rest of the scripture, bits and pieces. And think on them and delight in them and remind ourselves and say, this is for me. The Lord did this for me, and it's for me to appreciate and to tell him that I appreciate it and tell everybody else the same. And remember the very promise that he made to those two blind men who said, oh yes, we do believe you. We do believe that you can do this. And he said, according to your faith, be it unto you. And it is to us. According to our faith, be it unto us.